So hi everyone, I'm Catherine.
And I'm Simon.
And this is
Cosmos in the Cosmos. Billions are dead. Paul Muad'Dib Atreides has led a bloody jihad across the entire known universe and ruled as emperor for the past 12 years. Naturally, several factions don't like that he's in power and are conspiring to compose him. The Bene Gesserit, the Spacing Guild, and House Carino. Don't think we mentioned this, but House Carino is basically the house that controls the empire in the first book. And also the Bene Tlilax, who are briefly mentioned in the first book. I think that the Bene Tlilax are who trained Peter DeVries, but they're expanded on a lot more in the second book. And, they want him dead because he's kind of fucked up the whole power structure of the universe, and they're kind of grasping for straws as a result. In terms of characters, most characters are just returning from the first book, but we do get a few new characters, mostly Spacing Guild and Tlilaxu characters. Tlilaxu are the Bene Tlilax.
And the new Duncan.
Oh yeah, and the new Duncan, yes. He comes back as... Oh yeah, I don't think we mentioned he died in the first book. Yeah, he dies in the first book, and then he comes back to life in the second book.
Yeah, there's this dramatic scene where Paul goes to see Liet Keynes and tries to convince him that the Bene Gesserit should support him, and while they're talking about it, Sadokar show up and Duncan dies, defending Paul.
Yeah, so in terms of some new characters who are important... We get Edric, who's guild navigator, basically the top level, like, people in the guild who drive the spaceships and kind of look like horrible fish monsters because the spice has deformed their bodies so much. I think I mentioned that in order to navigate ships, guild navigators take a shit ton of spice so they can see the future. We also get Psytale, who's a fun character. He's a Lilaxu face dancer. So the Tlilaxu are basically, like, genetic engineers who can, like, create people with all kinds of crazy abilities. Face dancers have the ability to shapeshift, so Psytale can disguise himself as anybody he wants, and he's generally a pretty fun character. He has mysterious motives, and yeah, he's fun. I like Psytale. He's one of my favorite characters. And then we also get Hate, which is basically the Tlilaxu get Duncan Idaho's body at some point in Dune, and they decide to bring him back to life as a guy named Hate, who has, like, Mentat training, and they taught him all this philosophy, and he's, like, kind of an intellectual kind of guy compared to the original Duncan Idaho, who's a bit more of a swashbuckler. And they sent him to Paul as a means to try to break him down and so they can get in there and kill him, basically. And then there's also another fun character I want to talk about is Bijaz, who's this little dwarf who the Tlilaxu have created, who speaks in rhymes or I can't remember if he actually speaks in rhymes. I think he just speaks in riddles and is generally kind of a goof, kind of a fun character. I won't get into more of him because there's some spoilers, but yeah, yeah, he's messing with everyone. Just a fun character. I like Bijaz. I like the Tlilaxu in general, I think, are pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think they're an excellent faction to bring in because they have their own, like, weird philosophy and goals we don't know about. Like, part of Tlilaxu philosophy that I think is really interesting is they believe that when you trap an opponent, you need to always offer them a way out.
Yes.
And so I don't know. I thought that was really fascinating. But then also, they just have absolutely no morals about who they bring it back and what they turn them into. And that is really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I also wanted to bring up, I don't think I talked too much about Princess Irulan in the first book. She becomes a slightly more important character in the second book because now Paul is married to her. But Paul refuses to give her any children, so she's kind of just getting cucked, basically, by Chaney, who Paul is actually having sex with. And that's basically her whole character in this book. I feel like Frank Herbert doesn't do much with Princess Irulan, almost as, like, her character is, like, a weird joke character, because she's set up to be, like, an important character with all her history sections and all that in the first book, but she doesn't actually... She spends most of these books just completely unable to do anything because of the actions of other characters. I don't know. I feel like we need justice for Princess Irulan.
Yeah, Paul is pretty cruel to her. Well, basically, she is the daughter of the Emperor who is bred to be married to and have the heirs for the next regime, I guess. And then Paul marries her in addition to Chani so that he can have that legitimacy, but he refuses to let her have a kid and basically tells her that if she gets pregnant by someone else, he's going to kill her. So she's just miserable. And just, like, writes all these histories of Paul and wanders around the palace sadly.
Yeah. Again, justice for Princess Irulan.
Yeah, I mean, every chapter starts with something that she wrote in one of her histories. So I feel like she is pretty smart, and I think she deserved, as a person, the chance to, you know, marry and have kids with someone else, but alas, it was not to be.
Yeah.
But I think that of the characters that we get more of in book two, I would say Skytail is much more interesting.
I like Skytail. I think he's fun.
Yeah, well, because he is a face dancer.
Yeah.
You said that, right, Simon?
Yeah, I mentioned he's a face dancer.
But, like, I don't know if Simon made this clear. I don't think you did. That means that he can really look like anyone. And there's this really interesting thing back and forth where he makes himself look like someone that Paul knew when he was younger. An old Fremen woman who's dead now. And Paul does see through the charade, but there's this very interesting back and forth where Skytail is trying to make Paul believe the charade because he thinks he can convince him. And Paul is trying to make Skytail think he believes the charade.
Yeah. That's a funny part of the book. I do. Yeah.
I was tense. I liked it.
Yeah.
Is Skytail your favorite character in the second book?
I think I like Bijaz more. Bijaz is just so much fun as a character. I like the conversation he has with Hate towards the end. I forget most of what they talk about, but I remember liking the conversation. I think Hate is conflicted because he's partially been sort of programmed to... I forget if he's supposed to... He think he's supposed to assassinate Paul when he receives a certain phrase.
He's supposed to assassinate Paul when he says the phrase, "She is gone."
Yeah. That was it. But he also has part of Duncan Idaho's personality, so he's kind of conflicted about his mission. And he also has been taught all this Zen Sunni philosophy. I don't think we talked too much about... I don't know if it actually is mentioned in the first book, but
no.
There's this concept of Zen Sunni philosophy in Dune, which is, I believe, a combination of Zen Buddhism and Sunni Islam philosophy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's what the Fremen follow, because they're the Fremen. I don't think we talked about the history of the Fremen, but basically they're the Zen Sunni wanderers. Basically, people who were went around to a bunch of different planets and got enslaved a whole bunch and eventually made their way to Arrakis, where nobody else lived because it's a horrible shithole of a planet, but they managed to make a home for themselves there because people stopped, because nobody was around to oppress them, basically.
And then they became formidable enemies.
Yeah. So the Zen-Sunni philosophy ideas tie back to the Fremen as well. And, yeah, I mean, Haid is also a really interesting character because of his...
Yes.
Just general identity crisis. And I know, and like, Paul and Aaliyah are very aware that Haid has been sent to them basically to just kill them. Like, they're not stupid. They know that every faction is out to get them. But at the same time, like, they're trying to get all they can from him because, like, he was their...
it's also like... I mean, it's like one of these things where it's like, if Simon was murdered and someone sent me, like, someone who wasn't Simon but looked like Simon, I would probably not be able to turn it away, right?
Yeah.
Because Simon was my good friend. And it's this interesting push against, is Paul still human? Because he knows logically in his brain that can see the future that he's a trap. But Duncan was his friend. And so he can't turn away this other person who looks like Duncan.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic between, like, the Tlilaxu and Haid and the Atreides, just with this whole... Because in the end it's revealed... We're into spoiler territory, right?
Oh, yeah.
Are we? I don't want to give spoilers if we're not. Okay, cool. Because in the end, it's revealed that Haid was never actually really supposed... Well, so Haid was basically an experiment. Because they set him up to... They programmed him to kill Paul once he hears the phrase, "She is gone." But what they were expecting might happen is that... since he is basically a zombie of Duncan Idaho, that his personality would, like, come out in that moment and stop himself from killing Paul, and that would actually bring Duncan Idaho back, because Haid is, like, kind of Duncan Idaho, but not really. But in that moment, he would become Duncan Idaho, and that would prove to the Tlilaxu that coming back as a Golub basically means immortality. And so it's kind of a win-win for them. Either he gets the command, and then he kills Paul, and that helps out the Tlilaxu, because Paul is just kind of, again, broken the whole power structure of the universe. Or he refuses to kill Paul, and in the process becomes Duncan Idaho again. And that shows the Tlilaxu that if they die, they can come back as Golas and basically become immortal that way. And so that's the game the Tlilaxu are playing with Haid. And when you, like... I remember reading that section in the book where it's revealed that their whole plan was to test this Gola immortality idea. And then, like, going back to the section where Haid and Bijaz are having their conversation really kind of puts a new perspective on it, which I think is really cool. I don't know. I really like the Tlilaxu because they just have, they have goals that are just not at all what the goals of other factions are. The other factions are trying to seize power and control the universe, but the Tlilaxu are just trying to, like... It's not even really clear what their main objective is, but they're doing these, like, weird experiments and, like, all this crazy stuff. I don't know. Again, I really like the Tlilaxu as just a concept.
They have no morals in a very interesting way. Like, the Tlilaxu are just like, oh... Isn't it great that we found a way to bring people back from the dead? We did it by, we went through Duncan Idaho's memories and we realized that he thought the most fucked up thing he could ever do was to kill Paul because he thought of Paul as a son. So then we zombified him and made him try to kill Paul to bring him back into a human. Aren't we so cool and wonderful? And it's just like, they are really, really willing to do anything to bring humans back, and I respect the hustle. I also I just respect that they're willing to be like, we don't care about morals at all, that's not what this is about. Because, you know, the Bene Gesserit, for all of their willing to do anything, there's lines that they won't cross, and there's lines that the Emperor won't cross, and there's even lines that the Arcona won't cross, but there's no lines that the Tlilaxu won't cross. to bring people back. And in the first scene where he meets Skytail, the Klaatu, he's just kind of thinking about how much of an idiot the Bene Gesserit and the Spacey Guild are. And I also just loved that scene. But I don't know, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great scene, and I think it's a great introduction to the Tlaloxu, who, again, were briefly mentioned in the first book, but didn't really get any development. It just shows, like, they're on, like, almost another level compared to all the power struggle that's going on that we were already aware of in the universe. But then here's the Tlaloxu who are, like, just on their own mission, doing all, like, we're just way, like, kind of almost above it all. And by the end of Dune Messiah, you're not even 100% sure. Like, they want to figure out how to become immortal, and that makes sense, but their broader goals are still very unclear, which I think adds, like, kind of a cool mystery. Because, I mean, you have the Bene Gesserit who are, like, manipulating things behind the scenes and working in the shadows. But, like, as the reader, we're told pretty explicitly, like, what the Bene Gesserit are about and what their plans are. So there's not much of a mystery there. But with the Tlaloxu, it's like, what the hell are they even doing? They're just, yeah, I don't know. I really enjoyed the Tlaloxu and Dune Messiah. I think they're probably the most interesting faction.
Yeah, well, their whole thing, which really spoiler alerts, like very big spoiler alerts, this doesn't work, is that they want to show that Duncan can become human so that when Chani dies in childbirth, which they expect to happen because Erilyn has been for many years giving Chani a basically like contraceptive in her food. So when she does get pregnant, her pregnancy is very dangerous. They expect that she's going to die, and then they can show to Paul, we could bring her back as a full version of herself, you know, to make her return. And that's their plan, and we know that that's their plan, but we still never know, because what they're hoping to do is to get Paul to agree to that, and then Paul will be under their thumb. But we don't know why. We don't know what they want Paul to do. And that's very interesting to me.
Yeah. And to add on to the mystery, we're told, like, pretty much at the beginning of the book, that the Tlaloxu had their own program to try to create a Kwisatz Haderach, probably through, like genetic engineering, because that's their whole deal. But he, pretty sure it's implied he basically killed himself as soon as they tried to control him for their own ends. And that just, like, you know, the Bene Gesserit spent thousands of years trying to create a Kwisatz Haderach. Tlaloxu basically just figured it out and basically made one in a factory almost.
But I think it's interesting because their Kwisatz Haderach killed himself rather than be controlled. And at the end of the second book, Paul kills himself rather than be controlled. So I think it really pushes this idea of you can't create a being that has such a powerful understanding of time and expect them to submit to your whim. And I thought that was very interesting just as a whole back and forth, because the Tlaloxu and the Bene Gesserit both think that they have the ability to rule their Kwisatz Haderach creations, and both groups are completely wrong. So perhaps it's a lesson in humbleizing people.
Yeah. I think, again, it really comes back to the same. I'm going to probably talk about this, keep mentioning this, this idea of just not putting your faith in a great man. Because, I mean, in terms of the Gola immortality, like, the Tlaloxu succeed in figuring out how to use Golas to become immortal and, like, to trust in their own power, but they utterly fail at creating their own Kwisatz Haderach, and also in manipulating Paul to become their puppet emperor. Yeah, again, it comes back to this idea of, yeah, like, not trusting in a great man to lead you to victory.
Yeah, well, one of these things of the Bene Gesserit could have done so much over the generations if they were just focused on using their powers to push the emperor towards something good in their time, as opposed to creating a Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah.
And it's also this weird idea that a man's going to be more useful than a Bene Gesserit. It's like, is that even true?
Yeah, there's like a weird gender thing with the Bene Gesserit. Because like, the Kwisatz Haderach is basically like the only male Reverend Mother who can... Because the Reverend Mothers can access the genetic memories of the female side of their family tree. But I think the idea is that if there was a male Reverend Mother, he could access... like, his entire lineage, like, male and female sides. And it's a weird thing of just, like, oh, the women need a man to lead them. There's, like, a...
And it's, like, why?
Yeah, and it's, like, again, analyzing Frank Herbert a bit here, it is both, like, a kind of a pretty sexist idea that let this faction of all women really, what they really want is a man to lead them. But it's also almost like a bit of a subversion of that, because their pursuit of this idea of creating this male Reverend Mother who can, like, lead them and accomplish all their goals is pretty, like, detrimental to them in the end. Like, it really doesn't work out in their favor. It's almost saying, like, this idea that, like, women need a man is, like, just inherently flawed.
Well, in the second book, the head Reverend Mother ends up locked up by Paul.
Yeah.
And it's like, your faction spent so much time trying to create this man, and this man came alive, and he made his decision based on the world, and he locked you up. It's like, wow. What greatness you brought upon your life. But, and I mean, I think another thing about don't put your trust in a man is there's the whole idea in the first book that Paul is trying to find a way to prevent the Fremen from jihading across the universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the second book, as you know, we find out pretty early, and as Simon mentioned is in his intro, that did not happen. So jihad was not prevented.
Yeah, Paul utterly fails at preventing the jihad.
I mean, they do actually say, like, billions of people have died, right?
Yeah. I think it's 60 billion is the number they give, which is just an unfathomable amount of people. Basically, the Fremen go around to every planet, and if the people there don't submit to Paul's rule, they just cleanse the entire planet, just kill everybody. I believe is how it's described. It's pretty horrible what happens.
It's awful. I mean, and it's like, it's this interesting thing because, you know, we're taught to root for Paul and to believe that he is the hero and he is the good guy. But so many more people die under his regime than ever died under the previous emperor.
Yeah. And, like, his empire, too, is just, like, just completely tyrannical and dysfunctional. There's, like, one scene where they're talking about having a constitution to, like, you know, set, like, ground rules and put limits on his power. And Paul is completely against it. And he doesn't want any rule of law. He doesn't want any checks and balances. And, like, it's also just completely dysfunctional, too. He has, like, his priests basically ruling planets and just making up whatever laws they want. It's a complete disaster of a... basically.
Yeah, and he thinks he's so much smarter than the previous emperor. But there's nothing to really make us believe that is the case except for Paul can see the future. But it doesn't even feel like he uses that power that well.
No, it tends to hurt him more than it helps him. At least by the time of Dune Messiah.
Yeah, it feels like... So Dune Messiah is 12 years after the original book. And at the end of the first book...
Yeah.
Paul has just become control by being like, we'll stop destroying all your stuff if you make me your heir and let me marry Irulan. And then in the second book, he's in charge. 12 years later, and it just feels like nothing has gotten better, and if anything, it's gotten worse. Because he spent so much time worrying about how the future says that Chani's gonna die, that eventually he, like, follows a path of the future where Chani dies, but, like, in a less painful way, and he thinks that that's, like, worthwhile. But it's kind of like, what if you would just stop looking at the future and just tried to keep your wife alive and enjoyed life with her in the present?
Yeah. And it's also somewhat implied that the combination of... Because, so, what Paul sees is that when Chani... I actually don't know 100% how to pronounce her name, but when Chani or Chaney or whoever, or whatever her name is, dies, gives birth, that she will die. And he also knows that Irulan is giving her contraceptives. So he lets Irulan give her these contraceptives because he's hoping that this will just forestall her death forever, basically, hoping that she just never gives birth and thus just doesn't die in the way he foresees. But it's somewhat implied that the combination of the contraceptives she's been given and also the high spice diet that she's been taking as a way to try to, like, become more virile and try to get pregnant is actually part of what kills her in the end. So in that way, by trying to prevent her death, Paul actually caused it. And I don't know if that's entirely, like, the intended way to read that by Frank Herbert, but I think that's, like, a really interesting dimension to that, and kind of shows how Paul is kind of both doesn't really understand how his powers work, and is also just kind of, like, a pretty bad and useless person.
I think it is. She also dies without him. He doesn't go to see her give birth because his visions have told him that she's going to die. And he's like, I don't want to be there for that. And it's like, fuck you. I mean, you know, if I was married and my partner was giving birth, like, I would be there. And Paul should be there. The fact that he's not shows, to some extent, a callousness. That in his mind, she's already gone. But I'm sure the end of her life would have been better if she was there, right? I mean, if he was there, right?
Yeah, and it kind of comes back to, like, his inhumanity, like, way of being and his prescient powers kind of make him, like, almost inhuman. Like, he's kind of a monster, honestly. Just how he's trying to prevent Chaney's death in, like, very emotionless way almost, but just isn't there. He doesn't even think to be there, both when she's giving birth to his children, and, like, he knows she's gonna die in birth, and he doesn't even want to be there while she's dying. Like, I feel like you want to be around your loved ones when they're dying. Like, you want to be there to comfort them and say your goodbyes and everything, but Paul is just so, he's just kind of lost his humanity at this point.
I mean, forget, like, my wife. If, like, one of my friends was dying, I would want to be there.
Yeah.
Sure, he's like, oh, it's, like, a painful situation. Yeah, death is fucking painful. That's part of humanity. But you also, like, don't leave people you care about to die on their own.
Yeah.
It's, like, the book never really dwells on it, but it's, like, he's super weird and distant to Chani the day she's about to give birth. And then when she's pregnant and, like, really about to give birth, she's told that Paul can't be there because of political things. Well, Paul is just staring at the desert. Then she gives birth to two kids. Then she dies. And then Paul goes to look at the kids.
Yeah. I do think, like, Dune Messiah really completes the story of Paul, because it completely blows up any notion that he was really a hero. Because it's very heavily hinted that Paul really isn't the best guy in the first book. Like, he's leading the Fremen to serve his own ends, and he's having these visions of this jihad, and he's sort of trying to prevent it, but also in order to, like, get revenge for his house and secure his own power, he's pretty much causing it. So you can still maybe read the first book and get the impression that Paul is just, you know, a typical white savior, good guy here to help out the Fremen and get back at these evil Harkonnens and all that. But reading the second book, it's pretty clear that Paul is just, like, basically, he's basically Hitler.
Yeah. It's like, he wants revenge for the death of his father, and it's like, okay. But then he kills so many more people than the Harkonnens or the Emperor ever killed. And he turns himself into a god, and he turns his sister into a god, and he says that it's all for the common good, because his visions have told him this is how it has to be. But it really feels like a cop-out, right?
Yeah. And then there's also that scene where Paul and Stilgar, where Paul is basically telling Stilgar to review these tapes of these horrible dictators from Earth. And he's like, look at this Hitler guy. He killed 6 million people. I guess that's impressive, but I killed 60 billion. It almost feels a bit like he's bragging. In that scene, I think he's at this point realized what a horrible person he is. Is trying to convince Stilgar as well, because Stilgar is still like kind of a fanatical cheerleader, and Paul is a very conflicted character, I think, in Dune Messiah, because he's like, at this point, kind of realized how everything he's tried to accomplish has been really horrible, and like, led to the deaths of billions of people, and he's just generally realized what a horrible piece of shit he is, and so he's kind of hoping that someone will actually, like, assassinate him and depose him. He also kind of doesn't want that to happen, because, I mean, who wants to get assassinated and deposed?
But it's also like he's a bit of a coward because he doesn't want to change his policies. He just wants someone else to come and do better.
Yeah.
And, you know, courage in accepting you've done wrong is to fix it yourself.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to get into Children of Dune, but it also does explore this idea, because, yes, just to very briefly talk about it, because Paul's son, Leto, eventually does follow in his footsteps and actually does a much better job of it. Paul kind of made his son take on his responsibility because he was scared of it. She kind of made not a very good look for Paul. I do generally think he's a kind of a cowardly, kind of shitty person.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that Leto does better, and he does, that's true. But Paul should have been willing to change and try himself. And also, Paul dies when Leto is a baby. So Leto doing better is just an indictment of Paul. There's nothing that Paul did to improve Leto's performance, you know? Like, Paul's father was with him, trying to make him better as he grew up. Paul just walks into the desert and dies when Leto was a baby.
Yeah, that's true. He does just abandon his children and walk into the desert. Like, the man has no sense of responsibility.
Oh, no. And it's like this whole thing where it's like, he did that because that's like the Fremen tradition. But fuck the Fremen tradition, because he could have gotten fake eyes to see, or he could have just stayed as a blind advisor to his children. And he doesn't do that because he doesn't want to deal with what that would entail. But that is not looking out for his children. That is giving up because he wants them to deal with the problems that he didn't want to deal with. And also, he does let people worship him and Aaliyah as gods.
Yeah, he very much plays into the whole god worship thing. He claims to be, like, a bit against it, at least, like, he's a little skeptical of it in the first book, but he very much encourages it as well.
Yeah, I mean, he says that he doesn't want people to worship him as a god.
No.
But he made the temples in the rituals, and he makes his sister give opening and closing prayers each day, and she clearly hates it. So it really does feel like he is just... He's saying that he doesn't like things, but it's also necessary, and that feels like a cop-out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's his excuse for everything. Just, oh, I saw it in my vision. Oh, it's necessary for the greater good. Oh, I have to do this. It's just another way for him to do horrible things and avoid responsibility. Like, you can read Dune as a story of, you know, a man who's, like, kind of fucked up by all these powers he has and all this responsibility he feels and does these horrible things for the greater good. Or you can just read all of that as basically, like, propaganda that Paul has created to explain all his horrible things he does.
Yeah, I mean, he is 10 times worse than the emperor that he fought. And I don't know, I really think Aaliyah shows it because of how miserable he makes his sister in the name of running his empire. So As I think we mentioned, this book takes place like 12 or 13 years into the future. So Aaliyah is grown up and she has become essentially God and is forced to give these ceremonies every day where people ask her questions and she answers them after she does prayers. And she falls in love with Hate or Duncan Idaho. Because to some extent, he is the only man that she knows other than her brother who does not treat her with awe. Because her brother has forced her to live her life on this terrible pedestal.
Yeah. Now, Ali is a super interesting character in Dune Messiah. Because she's, like, she basically feels like she's not a person. Because, like, within her mind, she has all these genetic memories, like, basically shouting at her all the time since she was born, like before she was able to form like a real personality for herself. She's had all these voices in her head, and like on the outside she's worshipped as a god and has to like play the role of like this god figure for the Empire, and nowhere in there does she actually like get to be her own person. Like on both sides there's just like she's just being like shredded basically by all these other personalities that are enforced on her, and it kind of drives her insane to just like her lack of she also suffers from this lack of humanity, except unlike Paul, who got to be almost like a normal prince for like the first 14 years of his life or whatever, she's never been allowed to just be a person. She's always been like kind of a weird god figure, and she's kind of just suffers throughout the entire series.
And yet she still tries to take more responsibility for her actions than Paul ever does.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that she's never given any leeway for them. And also she's definitely treated in a weird sexist manner. Like, she is fighting after she takes a shower one day. She is naked fighting with her sword system. And her brother, like, just, like, walks into a room. Which, it's a little bit weird that she is fighting with her sword system naked. But also, don't walk naked into your sibling's rooms. Don't walk into your sibling's room without asking. Like, that's weird. But then also that he, like, berates her for what she's doing. And he's brought Stilgar as well. And Stilgar is like, you see how she's fighting things naked? That's proof she needs to be married. And it's just like, this is so weird. I don't know. That whole scene made me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's a really weird scene. And yeah, Aaliyah really doesn't. She gets treated pretty horribly.
Yeah, she really does.
Yeah, so that's two female characters. Actually, Chani also doesn't get treated very well by the narrative. In general, the female characters tend to, like, be treated pretty horribly.
Well, Chani is made to feel really bad for not having had a kid, despite the fact that Paul knows that the reason why she hasn't had a kid is because of the contraceptives that Erlen is giving her, and he just, like, hasn't told her.
Yeah.
Which, it's like, it just feels like he doesn't tell Chani anything important, which is so mean of him.
Yeah. And, like, he lets Erlen give her the contraceptives because he's seen this vision of her dying in childbirth, but he doesn't tell her that either. It's like he's both trying to prevent her death, but also, like, because he's the emperor now. He wants an heir. So he's, like, also kind of willing to let her die eventually. To give him an heir. Like, he treats Chani pretty horribly.
Yeah, he really does. I mean, she's clearly miserable in the palace and wishes they could go back to the desert, and he just refuses. And when she finally is pregnant, is about to give birth, he brings, like, all these people in the birthing party that clearly make her uncomfortable for his own weird political goals. And he doesn't, I don't know, he's never honest with her about it, and he never talks with her about it in the way that you should, you know? don't treat your partners the way that Paul treats Johnny.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not a good role model.
No, he's not. And he just, like, he just sees her as a piece of the puzzle to some extent. And it's like he wants her to have his heirs, but it's weird because it to some extent feels like if he really loved her, he would just let Irulan have a child and have that be the heir and let Johnny live.
Yeah.
Because the book establishes that, like, artificial insemination exists. So he could just, like, let Irulan artificially inseminate herself and have kids and have Johnny be, like, free and live. But he, like, doesn't want to do that for, like, political things. So he lets Johnny die.
Yeah.
It's one of these things where it's a question of, are the books supposed to be an indictment of sexism, or is Frank Herbert sexist?
Yeah, it is really hard to actually, like you said, if he's trying to make a statement on sexism, or if this is just an example of sexism in sci-fi literature, of which there are many. I don't have a good answer for that, because it is a little bit hard. It is not really clear if this is just Frank Herbert's sexism, or if this is trying to say something about sexism.
Yeah, and it just is hard to know what he was thinking. But I think it is undeniable that Aaliyah and Chani are treated unfairly. And then we have this weird thing where Lady Jessica is basically not a character in the second book, because she goes back to the planet where her and Duke Leto fell in love, Caladan. And she, like, supposedly writes Paul letters, but we never hear about her letters. We never hear about her opinion. And she's just kind of chilling there, which I think raises so many questions.
Yeah. It seems to be implied that she, like, disapproves of what Paul and Aaliyah are doing and sort of wants to distance herself from them. But, like, man, they're like her children. Like, I feel like if they're doing bad shit, she should be the one, like, guiding them or chewing them out or something. Like, again, coming back to the apparently just perennial Atreides
problems.
Lack of responsibility here.
It's also like she trained both of them and did things to both of them as their children in ways that made them fucked up. So if they are struggling and making bad decisions, she should be the person who is there being like, hey, don't do that. But she's not, because she's just like, okay, peace out. I'm gonna hang out on this other planet now. Bye, folks.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I was disappointed by that.
Yeah, I mean, her like narrative through line is that she goes against all the Bene Gesserit like wishes, creates, like, gives birth to these two children who kind of fuck up the universe, and then just sort of wrings her hands of the whole thing. And like, and she not just like giving birth to these children, but also she raised them both to like basically fulfill this prophecy, and then she sees what it actually looks like in practice and just doesn't want to have anything to do with it and doesn't take any responsibility for it. Again, all the Atreides characters come out looking really bad in this book.
Yeah, it's really interesting because in the first book, there's kind of this idea that they're like the better house versus the Arconans. But when they make an action and it goes wrong, no Atreides ever tries to take responsibility for and fix their actions. They just say, well, I fucked that up. Guess that's the way it is. I'm leaving now.
Either I'm leaving or I'm just going to take advantage of this and keep making it worse.
Yeah. And it's like, that is not the way it is meant to be.
Oh, and it's like, I think you sort of alluded to, like, the Atreides are introduced as being, like, the good guys. Like, Duke Leto is just, he's become so popular with all the other houses. He's a fair and just ruler. They're all so noble, and they take care of their friends. And then just the first two books really just deconstruct all of that and show just how manipulative and awful the Atreides really are. I know in the, I guess just mentioning something from the first book, there's one scene where Duke Leto laments just how good his propaganda is and how how everyone has this vision of him as just being such a great guy. And he kind of feels a bit like, a bit shitty about it, like how he's really just manipulating people and using people's loyalty against them. And that theme just keeps, like, they keep building on that through the whole book. And it kind of just shows how the traitors are really pretty manipulative.
Oh, yeah. But I think the thing is that even though Duke Leto feels bad about it, like, I feel like Paul's father is, like, genuinely like a good guy who's genuinely trying to do the best with his reign. And then we have Paul, who is not genuinely trying to do the best with his reign, but still benefits from that same level of propaganda as his father.
Yeah.
But we also have this thing where Paul is trying to know the future at all times, right? And he's taking more and more spice as he tries to know the future, even though he can't see things. And there's this point where he knows the future so well that he has literally become blind and is still can act things out like he's in his vision. But he doesn't know that he's going to have a son alongside his daughter. But when his, like, Chani mentions the possibility that, like, she's pregnant with two babies, he literally, like, never even thinks to ask. And then he has a son who's, like, an all-knowing baby who can, like, talk to him. Which, that's kind of a weird form of sexism in and of itself, that it's the son, not the daughter, who can do that.
Well, doesn't the daughter also have that same ability? Like, isn't she also... They're both pre-born, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the daughter has some abilities, but she doesn't... He can't see through her eyes. She doesn't talk to him in quite the same ways. Her abilities manifest within the third book.
Right, yeah.
Whereas Leto is always special. But it's this weird thing where he's so focused on his visions that he doesn't even think to investigate the possibility that they aren't completely right.
Yeah. And, like, when the twins are born and he realizes that, like, he has two children instead of just one and his vision was wrong, it kind of just breaks him completely. Like, he loses the ability to see the future in that moment, or at least the ability to trust his visions. And, like, I think that's the moment when he kind of makes up his mind to go out into the desert. Both, it does feel both like a way to just evade responsibility, but also because he kind of realized just how he's complete, how his vision of himself as this all-seeing, all-knowing guy is just kind of a lie. And, like, reading into it a bit, in that moment, it's almost like all the horrible things he's done, thinking it's been for some grand vision of the future he foresees, like, he realizes it might just all just be bullshit. He's, like, kind of been fed on his own propaganda for so long, and he finally becomes disillusioned with it all in that moment.
Yeah, well, I think it's this thing, too, where if he's not all-seeing, if he's not completely right, then there's a chance that if he had actually, like, paid attention to the present and been there and done things, they could have saved Chani. And he wasn't even, like, willing to consider that was a possibility, which I think is another, like, fuck you, Paul moment. That he's just like, well, my visions say that she has to die, so that's the way it is. I'm not even gonna see if there's a possibility to improve that.
Yeah.
No, I think the only other thing that I would say is I do think that Paul is unfair to Irulan in the second book, too. I think it's really cruel to be like, you're married to me, but also you can't have kids with the other people or I'll kill them.
Yeah. I do also kind of feel like Frank Herbert mistreats Irulan. Like, in the second, and the, like, getting into the third book again a little bit, it's mentioned at one point that, like, the other Bene Gesserit don't really think much of her in terms, like, her abilities as a Bene Gesserit aren't that great, but she's only important because she's married to Paul. And it's kind of just a, that's kind of just a fuck you to her. Like, damn. She doesn't get anything in these books.
Well, everyone says that she's dumb, but we don't actually see much to prove that. I don't know. I think she's just, I think she's a fairly intelligent person who was raised to marry and bear the children of the next emperor and just really wants kids. And I don't think that the fact that she wants kids means that she's dumb, you know? Plenty of intelligent people really want children.
And that does sort of put me more in the, I think Frank Herbert might just be sexist, may have just made a sexist book kind of category. Because, yeah, it is sort of implied that she is kind of dumb because she wants kids.
I would kind of agree with that because there's like this one note character that sometimes exists in characters such as Princess Erelyn, but also if you've ever seen The Witcher, the main female character in The Witcher, I would say also falls into this camp of woman who is smart and powerful and has other abilities, but has decided the only thing that bothers her in life is she can't have children. And it's like, when have you ever seen a male character like that? Because male characters are always like, ah, we rise beyond this. And female characters are like, oh no, it's all that matters. So yeah, I think that does make me feel like it's more into the he's a little bit of a sexist boy category.
It's like, this is real speculation, but it feels like he's in like the category of sexist where like he's aware of the idea of like women's purpose being to have children is a sexist idea, but he kind of blames women for it, like as if just a woman wanting to have children is what's perpetuating this sexist idea, which is in of itself like a sexist idea. Yeah, that's kind of my read on Frank Herbert in terms of that.
Yeah, I could see that. I don't know, he was a bit of a weirdo. Well, I mentioned before that his wife died in 1984 and he died in 1986, right?
I think you mentioned he died in 1986, but I don't remember about his wife.
But the thing that's weird about that is his wife died in 1984 and he remarried his agent in 1985 before he died in 1986. And I do think that's a little bit strange.
Yeah.
I don't know. Remarrying the year after your wife of like 40 years has died. It's a bit much. But, yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I really want to say about the second book. I think the other thing I would just say is that the Fremen have really been completely ruined culture-wise in the second book. They've been turned completely into Paul's, like, slaves that do his bidding. And it feels like he slightly resents them for that, but also that's what he made them.
Yeah, and we do see as some of the Fremen do kind of realize how much they've been, like, how much they've been spun around. I forget the name of the character. I think it's like Oithem or something. But he was one of the Fedaiken warriors who was sent out to all the planets to just, you know, make people submit or die. And somewhere along the way, he like kind of realizes how fucked up this all was, and like that he doesn't really agree with it. I think he joins the conspiracy. Can't quite remember, but I think there might be like a faction of Fremen who do join the conspiracy against Paul just because they realize like how much they've been screwed over and toyed around with by his regime.
And that their culture has been destroyed.
Yeah, and that's brung up a lot about how the Fremen have become water sick and they've lost all their cultural institutions. Like the younger generations of Fremen have no concept of water conservation, and they just have like that Fremen have just kind of stopped being really a people and are just sort of Paul's playthings at this point.
Yeah, and some of them are just go along with it, and the smarter of them resent it and are fighting Paul, and you can't really blame them. So I think we're wrapping up now. So the final thing that I really wanted to say is that I do feel like even though Dune Messiah doesn't get the level of acclaim that Dune does, that it is really an important conclusion to the story of the first book, because the first book leaves it very open-ended if Paul is going to succeed or not. And the second book is like, to be clear, Paul did not succeed. And so I think it's really important to read both of them to get Frank Herbert's message.
I think Dune and Dune Messiah is basically together a complete story. I know Dune, the original Dune, is split up into three books, and to me it kind of feels like Dune Messiah is like the fourth book. I don't think Dune really makes as much sense without Dune Messiah. I know Denis Villeneuve, who did the Dune adaptation after Dune Part 2, wants to also adapt Dune Messiah and basically make it a trilogy that way, which I think makes a lot of sense, because it really does just complete the story of Paul. And I think it's a really interesting story about, like, both the rise of this, you know, chosen one character, but then also the fall. The only other real example I can think of in, like, mainstream media of this type of character is, like, Anakin Skywalker. And that's not nearly as well done with him as it's done with Paul.
Oh, God. Yeah, the prequels of Star Wars are so bad.
Yeah. I really hope they greenlight a Dune Part 3 based on Dune Messiah. I think it'll be a really interesting trilogy of movies. And I really like the first... I do think the first two Dune books really go together.
Yeah, and then I think the third one is something else. But I do have to say... I can tell you're from Ontario, Simon, because it's Denis Villeneuve.
Oh, it's Denis Villeneuve.
it's the French-English divide. This is why all of our listeners should watch Bon Cop, Bad Cop.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I agree with Simon that it is one story. It really, even though it is technically two separate books, the first Dune book is to some extent not complete without Dune Messiah. Which is why I want to talk about both of them. So if you are interested in reading Dune, I think you got to read Dune Messiah to appreciate the whole story. And you should watch the Denis Villeneuve movies and then write in and say that Dune Messiah should be greenlighted as the third movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah, then we got to advocate for Children of Dune adaptation, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune. You know, the whole series. Keep Denis Villeneuve in business for the next 50 years making Dune movies.
Yes. So Denis Villeneuve makes Dune movies forever, which is the real point of this podcast, is supporting Denis Villeneuve. I do enjoy the Dune books after Dune Messiah, but they're on a different level of madness.
Yeah, they get pretty wild after Dune Messiah. I mean, Dune Messiah is already pretty wild, but they just get completely out there.
Well, Dune Messiah is like, there are some people that have the ability to see most of the future. In Children of Men, Children of Dune is like, what if people were turning into worms now?
Yeah.
Which is another level. But yeah, so anyway, should we sign off, Simon?
I think, yeah.
Okay, well, bye, listeners. Keep it zesty.
Keep the spice flowing.